This is actually chapter 3 of the textbook these are taken from. Like I said, the chapter is meaningless if you're using a different textbook. But we're skipping over stuff that is important, but I just don't have time to fit in, which is a kind of a primer on chemistry. I'll talk about chemistry as I need to here and there, but I'm not going to devote a chapter to it. What we're looking at in this opening slide are cells. And by the way, the cell is an important structure in terms of definition. If I ask you what an organism is, what is the answer? What was it? Yeah, an organism is something that contains at least one cell. So there are other biotic entities having to do with biology, like viri, for instance. A virus is not an organism. It's really a collection of macromolecules. At the smallest, a virus is nothing but a nucleic acid and a protein. So it's much smaller than a cell, but it's not size that matters here. It's the fact that it doesn't have a cell. A cell is the fundamental unit of life. So life itself is kind of hard to define. We really define life usually by listing 6 or 7 things that living things have in common, like using energy, reproducing themselves, and so on. It's true that living things have these properties, although some non-living things have some of those properties as well. Anyway, the only thing that is able to undergo all of these processes that we collectively call life are cells. And so you live because you have cells. And a cell really is a little test tube locked away from the rest of the universe. And the reason it's locked away from the rest of the universe is because every cell features a boundary between itself and the rest of the universe, and that boundary is the plasma membrane. Every cell that's ever existed has had a plasma membrane. Well, the point of this slide is that there's a huge variety of cell types, not only from species to species. So if you confine your attention to just microscopic life, unicellular organisms, there's a hell of a variety of cell shapes and types when you go from one species of unicellular organism to the next. But also, just within one individual of a multicellular species like us, there's a big variety of cell types within that one individual. And they're not only different with respect to what they do, so what is going on inside them differs from cell to cell, but they're just outwardly different in how they're shaped. So squamous, cuboidal, and columnar, those are words that we use to describe epithelial cells, cells that make up epithelial tissue. Squamous means flat, like floor tiles, not very thick in that direction. Cuboidal is about the same height as width. Columnar is taller than it is wide, like a column. These aren't just random differences, of course. The reason that there are differently shaped cells is because the form in biology usually goes hand in hand with the function. Form fits function is a really major theme of all biology, not just anatomy and physiology. We've come to look the way we are, both macroscopically and microscopically, because of natural selection operating over long periods of time from generation to generation. There are slow changes. This is evolution, right? So cells are shaped the way they are because that works. And other shapes did not work as well and therefore did not get passed on to another generation. So some are shaped like polygons, some are shaped like stars, which is what stellate means. Stella means star. Like little spheres, which is really the kind of the what you normally think of as a cell shape. An isolated cell that doesn't have some sophisticated shape is usually roughly spherical. But cells are not in isolation in a multicellular organism, and they can be deformed into some other shape by association with other cells that are adjacent to them. So cells are stuck to each other, and that's part of what gives them their shapes. Discoid, fusiform, fibrous, other examples. Just a big variety of cell shapes. Let's go on to two now. So we are multicellular organisms, I keep saying that. Anyone have a guess as to how many cells are in your body? Yeah, it's one shitload would be an answer. But I mean, what's another unit we could use? Millions is true, but we could say there are tens. That would also be true. Millions doesn't really do it justice. There are literally trillions. An average human will contain roughly 10 trillion cells, an adult human. That means a million million, right? Is a 10 million million is 10 trillion. That's a lot. But those are just the cells that you can lay claim to. In other words, those are the cells that you, in a sense, own because those are the cells that contain your DNA. But in the space that you call your body, the space that you occupy as an individual, really has somewhere between 10 and 100 bacterial cells for every one of your own cells. So in terms of number of cells occupying this space that you call yourself, the population is mostly bacteria. Bacterial cells are much smaller than your own cells, though, so in terms of volume, you can make up for it that way. Anyway, about 10 trillion cells. And the point here is that we are huge organisms. Now, there's plenty of things that are much bigger than we are, but we are by far bigger than most things that exist, most living things that exist. And we don't get this size, but we all start out as one cell, right? What is that one cell called that we start from? The zygote, yes, which was formed by the fusion of an egg from your mother and a sperm from your father. That one-celled zygote is how we really start. We don't become the size we are as adults by having that zygote enlarge into one huge cell. And that's never going to happen for any species. It's not just that it didn't happen for us. It won't happen because a cell with that dimension, with those dimensions, wouldn't function. Wouldn't be able to undergo the things that make a cell alive. Specifically, it wouldn't be able to metabolize. Metabolism is the collection of all the biochemical reactions that are occurring within a cell, if it's a unicellular organism, or within the entire organism, if it's a multicellular. So that's really what life is. Chemical reactions that are occurring within cells. Metabolism is life. That wouldn't happen in a big cell. And the reason is because organisms and cells are examples of what are called thermodynamic open systems. I don't want to get too deep into thermodynamics here, but in thermodynamics you have open systems, closed systems, and isolated systems. A system can be anything you want as long as you define it. It's some subset of the universe. So it could be a chemical reaction, it could be a cell, it could be a whole organism. Anyway, if the system is open, what that means is that it is exchanging both energy and matter with the surroundings, which is the rest of the universe. All organisms, all living organisms, have to be open systems. Because in order to undergo metabolism, there has to be a continual exchange of materials and energy with the surroundings. We can't live in isolation from the rest of the universe. All right? Well, where do you think that exchange takes place at a cell? naturally enough, the exchange takes place where the boundary between the cell and the surroundings is, right? Which is the plasma membrane. The plasma membrane is where there has to be exchange between the cell and the surroundings, whether it's bringing something in that you need or getting rid of something that you don't need. That's going to happen through the plasma membrane. And cell size is constrained or put into check. There's a maximum put on it because of what is called the surface area to volume ratio, which obviously is the ratio of surface area to volume. A surface area of the cell divided by the volume of that same cell is the surface area to volume ratio. So the higher that number is, since surface area is the numerator and volume is the denominator, the higher that number is, the more surface there is for exchange of materials into and out of that volume. Okay? And that number can only get so small before it becomes impossible to exchange enough materials for that volume with such a small surface area. The reason the constraint is put on cell size is because if you just think of a normal cell, think of it as a cube like this, just for mathematical ease. If you double that cell size in all of its three dimensions, so you make it twice as wide, twice as tall, twice as deep simultaneously, you're not doubling the surface area and doubling the volume, right? Think about how these two quantities are measured. The surface area is going to be 6 times the surface area of each face, right? Each face has an area that is the length times the height. So, if you start out with 1 by 1 by 1, the volume is 1, the surface area is 6, right? Because the surface area of each face is 1 times 6 faces. You double it in each dimension, now you have a 2 by 2 by 2. So each face is now 2 times 2, which is 4, times 6 is 24, right? That's the surface area. But the volume is now 2 times 2 times 2, which is 8, correct? So the surface area to volume ratio went from 6 divided by 1, or 6, to 24 divided by 3, or no, 24 divided by 8, which is 3, right? So it went from 6 to 3. The surface area to volume ratio went from 6 to 3 when we doubled the cell size in all three dimensions. Everyone clear on that? In other words, growing a cell in all three dimensions is going to reduce the surface area to volume ratio. So if you continue to make this cell bigger and bigger in all three dimensions, you'll eventually get such a low surface area to volume ratio that that huge volume contained in the cell won't be able to be serviced by the small amount of exchange that this surface area can support. And therefore, organisms don't get huge by growing their cells to be huge cells. Instead, organisms become multicellular, and their large bodies are made out of a huge number of small cells, each of which individually still has a high surface area to volume ratio. So individual cells can still have enough exchange within the body. Does that all make sense? By the way, I keep saying that you need to grow in all three dimensions for it to be constrained. That's why there are exceptions to the cells are small rule. For instance, a neuron in a giraffe goes all the way from its toe to the base of its spinal column or spinal cord, which is, I don't know, what is that, 10 feet or something? That's one cell that's 10 feet long. Sorry about the non-metric. The reason that's not a violation of this constraint on surface area to volume ratio, though, is because it didn't grow in all three dimensions. It got long, but it still is very narrow and very shallow. So that volume did not really get huge because you're only extending, you know, it doesn't contain all that much. It still has surface that's very close to the volume that it's near. Does that make sense? Another way of thinking about this is that when you make hash browns, assuming that what you like about that is the browning, you don't throw a whole potato into the skillet. It will brown, but you won't have a very high ratio of browning to potato. When you cut it into tiny shreds, each individual shred now has a much higher surface area to volume ratio, and it's the surface that browns. All right, let's go to 3. Look at a cartoon of an animal cell. So this is one of your cells, for instance. It's kind of a catch-all figure in that all of the major parts to cells are shown here, even though not any given cell is going to necessarily have every one of these parts to it. But what we're looking at are mostly organelles, subcellular structures, structures that are just parts of cells. They're smaller than the cell themselves. So we animals are, of course, eukaryotes. So our cells are eukaryotic, which means that they have a true nucleus. That is the purple thing. And the nucleus is just one example of a membrane-bounded organelle. By the way, the phrase membrane-bounded and the phrase membrane-bound are not the same thing, and I use them both. So let me just tell you the difference. Membrane-bounded means enclosed by its own membrane, surrounded by its own membrane. Bounded is the means having a boundary with. On the other hand, membrane-bound means bound to a membrane. In other words, tied to a membrane. Bound is the past tense of bind. So in other words, we have proteins that are membrane-bound because they are part of the membrane. They are tied to that membrane. But we have organelles that are membrane-bounded because they are enclosed by their own membranes, separate from the plasma membrane. And that's really the hallmark of a eukaryotic cell. It not only has a nucleus, that's why it's named that, but it also has other membrane-bounded organelles as well, which we don't find in prokaryotic cells. So the nucleus is an example of that, but so is the endoplasmic reticulum that surrounds it, this kind of folded arrangement of membrane that is in close proximity to the nucleus itself, is the endoplasmic reticulum. And the endoplasmic reticulum overall can be subdivided into rough and smooth parts. The rough endoplasmic reticulum gets its name because there are ribosomes associated with its surface. Each ribosome is itself a little non-membrane bounded organelle that whose job it is to create proteins. So the rough endoplasmic reticulum's major job is to receive the proteins that these ribosomes that are associated with it make and refine them some way and send them along their way. The smooth endoplasmic reticulum, which has a different shape to it, but it's all continuous with the rough. This is the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. That does various things like synthesis of lipids. But what we're really going to talk about in this class, in this course, as far as a job of the endoplasmic reticulum is concerned, is the storage of calcium ions, which is really going to be important in the functioning of skeletal muscle tissue, which for most people will be the most difficult part of this course. So look forward to that. Now we also have in orange mitochondria. That's the plural. A mitochondrion is an organelle whose job, it's several jobs, but its main job is cellular respiration. Cellular respiration is a complex biochemical set of pathways that allows for fuels to be oxidized, which releases energy. Some of that energy gets captured and put to use, storing some of that energy in the form of ATP molecules. ATP is a versatile energy-carrying molecule that organisms use, not just humans. And so we eat things so that we can store some of the energy that's contained in those chemical bonds in the form of ATP molecules, which then can be broken down again in order to release that energy so that we can do things that require energy. Metabolism, well, I won't get into that. There's a lot of things that require energy. That's what the mitochondria are for. The Golgi complex in green is a membrane-bonded organelle whose job it is to receive modified proteins from the endoplasmic reticulum, figure out where they need to go, and send them on their way. So it's a receiving and shipping center, if you want to analogize it. The centrosome that's listed up there with centrioles in it, that centrosome is a microtubule organizing center, which becomes important when one cell gets ready to split into two cells, either by mitosis or meiosis. The centrosomes are important for that. The vesicles that we see are just little bags of membrane that can be carrying various things. A secretory vesicle is a vesicle that will eventually fuse with the interior of the plasma membrane and release its contents to the outside of the cell. Secretion, in other words. Secretory is just the adjective form of secretion. And so this is how cells that secrete things usually secrete whatever it is they're secreting, by packaging it into little vesicles and then having those vesicles dump the contents out of the cell. At the very top of the cell has an undulated appearance that we call, each one is called a microvillus. Villus means finger-like projections. Projection, villi is the plural. So a microvillus is just a small finger-like projection. You see many of them on that one surface. Only on that one surface, by the way, notice. A perfect example of this would be the lining of the gut. Your small intestine has what as its major function? Absorption of the nutrients that you've broken your food down into. So after digestion takes place earlier in the alimentary canal, that all that stuff is still outside of your body. Your body is really just wrapped around the tube we call the digestive tract. To get that into your body means it needs to be absorbed into cells through that epithelial lining. And doing that takes a lot of surface area. The more surface area you have, the more availability you have for these molecules of nutrients to come into the cell. Forming a microvillus, rather than just being smooth, is a way of drastically increasing the surface area without actually drastically increasing the volume. Right? Because the little spaces between each microvillus are not part of the cell's volume. They're outside of the cell. So it's really roughly the same volume it would be as if you had a smooth epithelium right through the center of each microvillus. But if you imagine that being a beach, walking along a straight beach would be a lot shorter than walking along this undulated beach. So there's a lot more surface area there, and that's what microvilli are all about, drastically increasing surface area for when it's appropriate. That's enough for that. Let's go on. When do we get out of here? Quarter till? All right. Remind me when I'm about 10 minutes past. Just a joke. Slide 4 now. Well, I told you about the importance of the plasma membrane in terms of its being the defining character of any given cell. The plasma membrane, though, is an ancient structure. It's been around since cells have been around. Now, we all are descendants of that first cell billions of years ago. But all cells that have come from that, all cells in the history of life have featured a plasma membrane that, even though there's differences in their structure from one cell to another, even within one multicellular organism, all plasma membranes have basically the same substructure. They are principally made out of special molecules called phospholipids, which are the yellow-colored things here, yellowish-orange. And it's impossible to overstate the importance of phospholipids to the evolution of life. We just wouldn't exist without them. And that's because they have a special chemical property, each individual phospholipid. It's called that because it's part lipid, but it has a phosphate group attached to it. The phosphate groups are the globular or spherical yellow heads. Each one has two tails. Those are the lipid parts. Anyway, the special property is that each phospholipid is an example of a molecule that is said to be amphipathic. A-M-P-H-I-P-A-T-H-I-C. And what does that word mean? Well, what does amphi mean as a combining form? Did you say something?
Both.
Yes, both. For instance, in the word amphitheater, right? An amphitheater is a theater that is partly inside and partly outside. And pathic, pathos, refers to feeling. So amphipathic literally means something like dual feeling or dual preference. And that's because an amphipathic molecule is one that has a polar region, a part that is either partially or fully charged electrically, and another part of the same molecule that's nonpolar, not charged at all. Water is an example of a polar molecule. All right? And a plasma membrane forms a boundary between two aqueous environments. Two environments that are watery. It's not just pure water, but water with other things dissolved in it. Okay? Well, the polar, things that are polar don't mind being around other things that are polar, like water molecules. But nonpolar things don't interact well with polar things. They interact well with other nonpolar things. So things like likes to be around like. So if you just, without any life, take a bunch of non-living individual phospholipids, take a few million of them and put them into water, pure water, no life at all, they will spontaneously form what is called a phospholipid bilayer. Now, that's not a true plasma membrane, but this is how the first cell got started. It's because the plasma membrane is more than just the phospholipids. But the phospholipids themselves will form a little bag just on their own. And it's called a bilayer because it's two layers of phospholipids. The phospholipids in one layer will line up so that the phospholipids in the other layer have their tails pointing to the tails of the first layer. The heads are on, are facing inward and outward with respect to the cell. Okay, so the reason this happens automatically is because the heads, the little balls, are the polar parts, and they don't mind being around water, which is inside the cell and outside the cell. The tails are nonpolar because they're lipids. They don't want to be around the water. So by being just around themselves, they're excluding themselves from being near either the external or the internal water. That's how the first cell got created, and we all came from that first cell. Okay? So just the fact that we have amphipathic molecules is the reason that life was able to evolve to begin with. That's why I said it's impossible to overstate its importance. But a functioning cell can't just have a plasma membrane that's nothing but phospholipids, because certain things can slip right through the phospholipid bilayer, like nonpolar things that are small enough. CO2, for instance, can go right through the phospholipid bilayer. We rely on this when we want to get rid of that CO2. Comes right out of the cell, goes into the blood cell, goes right out of the blood cell into the lung space, and we exhale it. Same for oxygen coming in. There's plenty of other things, though, that because they're either too big or they are polar or charged, can't get right through the phospholipid bilayer. And they, therefore, need the help of some sort of protein that's membrane-bound, part of that actual membrane. So the overall plasma membrane is a rich mixture of phospholipids of different types, along with a bunch of other things in it, like proteins that can be just proteins by themselves or proteins with other things connected to them. Glycoproteins are proteins with sugars connected to them. Lipoproteins are proteins with lipids connected to them, and so on. Plus you have, as animals, cholesterol in there in the mix. Cholesterol is an example of a lipid that is important for various reasons that we'll talk about later, but I'm out of time. Yeah. No, there isn't a lab this week, so if you do attend, I won't be there. Well, you won't be able to get in.